Hello, my name is Simon Ward, and I would like to welcome you to the Triathlon Coach podcast. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic champions and covering all distances from sprint to Ironman. Now it's my goal in this weekly 30-minute podcast to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. So as I've already said, we've got just 30 minutes, so let's get rolling with today's guest. Hey listeners, welcome back. This is Simon Ward with another fantastic guest today. And this week we are taking a little sidestep. We're going behind the scenes and we are going to be talking to Mr. Brad Devaney. Now, Brad is the bike design guru for Quintana Roo. And Quintana Roo have been around in the sport of triathlon for quite a long time. I think they were right there at the very beginning. And certainly in the UK, they took a bit of a back seat, but they're back now in full force. And I really wanted to get Brad on the show today to talk about aspects of bike design and where things are going. So firstly, Brad, welcome to the show. It's 8 o'clock in the morning there, is it? Oh, no, 9 o'clock, I think.
Yeah, we're well into our day here. Good to be with you, Simon.
Yeah, thanks for joining us today. So before we get into how you go about starting with a bike design, Brad, let's just delve into your history. So how did you get into this particular aspect of the sport? Did you go to engineering college from school?
Yeah. So as an engineering student, there just happened to be a budding bike brand in our region, in our district. And you know, being a student and a cyclist, I was a racing cyclist, off-road and on-road. My best friends were triathletes, and so I was just in the mix of a lot of things. And, you know, somehow or another happened onto the guys, or maybe, I'm quite sure how we crossed paths, but the guys that were developing this little niche brand called Lightspeed. Yeah, we got on really good, and it all really started there. So lots of fun. I was very fortunate to step into it.
I can't think of anything better if you're an engineer and you love cycling to find that there was some work for you working with a company developing bikes. That's sort of like nirvana, isn't it?
It really, really is. You look back and there's lots of people to be grateful toward, but I think there was some intervention there somehow. I don't know. Kind of pinch myself every day. So,
well, you saw. I always think that you make your own luck in life, and you know, some people that perhaps didn't have an open mind to networking and what other people were doing might have missed that opportunity. But I guess if you were an ambitious and inquisitive and slightly creative person, you might have seen that opportunity and thought, well, I wonder if I can work this and see where it goes.
Yeah, I'm definitely a product of that. So thank you.
So now I know from what you told me before that you've worked with some of the most influential and significant people to have been involved in not just bike design, but design of components, and some of them groundbreaking in the last 20, 30 years in the United States. Steve Head being one, and John Cobb. So can you just explain to us a little bit about how you came into contact with those guys, and maybe tell the listeners who might not be aware of some of the innovations that they were involved with?
Yeah. So I had, working not only as a, in design, but I was working in the fabrication shop with Lightspeed for a number of years. And I had kind of stumbled upon an aerodynamic tube shape. You know, with titanium, shaping isn't easy. And so we're very unconventional in how we use our raw materials. And I'd created, somewhat of an aerofoil tube shape. And we built a bike. I had a really hot project going on at the time with Team Zed, Greg LeMond squad. Mm. And it looked as though Greg might be looking at a potential hour record attempt. and I jumped all over it. I mean, just literally built the frame for it. And, you know, had collaborated a bit. Hey, this, you know, what would you want? I know track bikes. I know, you know, and you know, Greg really was one of those athletes that wasn't so particular, you know, so long as his position was what he felt it should be. And we knew his road position, we knew his time trial position. And so to design beneath those positions was something I think that was quite unique that I was doing at the time. And so we dove right into that. And that's really where a lot of that began. Now, with, you know, that being some of the first aero, there was a lot of my aero experience from a design standpoint. We immediately started to reach out for some more intellectual resources, and Steve was that. So it sort of, you know, just started in conversation. We'd send a frame, we'd send whatever, you know, just some simple collaboration, and it was always so casual with Steve, and that's really where it began.
What was so this would be what towards the end of Greg LeMond's cycling career, so sort of early to mid 90s, would it?
Yeah, very early 90s. Yeah, quite early in that. So, yeah.
So, Steve Head, how would people know him? What innovations was he known for within the cycling industry? Because he died quite young, didn't he, Steve? I think he didn't make it to his 60th birthday, which was tragic, really, for the bike industry.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, Steve, at that point in time, he just had fantastic aero wheels. There's, and in my opinion, there's no one that touched what Steve was doing. He was such an innovator. You could go out and buy, you know, a Campagnolo disc. It was inferior to that what Steve had already created. And Steve built his disc wheels on any hub shell platform you wanted. If it was a threaded free wheel, if it was that odd thing we were calling the cassette back then, you know, he was just a can do, very unassuming guy, and always open to a suggestion.
So, and most people would know of Head wheels. So that is Steve Head, really, isn't he? That's what you're talking about there with those wheel sets.
Yep. And Steve was just such a champion of athletes. You know, there's so many instances where you would see Steve helping an athlete and never promoting his name through it. And forever, always really respected that about Steve.
Well, wasn't there a story about his wife and how he helped her to do her first Ironman? And she became the CEO of his company, didn't she?
Yes, fantastic story. Yeah. Beautiful story.
Well, and of course, you know, at that point, you know, Head and Zip were the two behemoths of the bike wheels world, really, weren't they?
Well, Zip really hadn't come on as we know them today. You know, they hadn't come on yet. They weren't an option, in my opinion. Hmm. They came on mid-90s quite strong, but in this period. That we got started, I'm not sure, you know, where Zip, I can't recall what their product range was other than the rims. And it was just an option, you know, but when it came to true aero innovation, Steve was the driver. And then as Zip developed, of course, they took a very professional approach quite a corporate approach, and I respect both ways they went about their business. Mm, mm. Steve's always, you know, his goal was to manage a small business. He didn't want it to grow too big or to become too commercial. That just wasn't his style. And you know, he's always managed a healthy business, and he had kept it a certain size for a reason.
So Cobb, is it John Cobb, wasn't it? Is that right?
Yep.
So John Cobb, you collaborated with him on a number of projects, I think. And I know you still meet up with him. Yeah.
It's funny. We had we'd done time trial bikes and specialty climbing bikes, and you know, had bikes all over the Pro Tour with other logos. You know, Lightspeed wasn't a brand, and to this day isn't a brand that's going to be out sponsoring the Pro Tour team. But you know, I'm working behind the scenes designing bikes for some pretty special guys, and John, he did a lot of behind the scenes work, and just another very crafty guy, and such a brilliant guy. I mean, he's just a great puzzle worker, as Steve was. And but Lance Armstrong had an accident. He was on his way to the it was about 2 weeks before, maybe within 2 weeks. I had a really short time window, but there was a crash. I think bikes were racked on top of a car. There was a crash. The rack was ejected from the car, as I'm told. I don't know all the details, but I get a voicemail from Lance. And it, apparently he was maybe standing over the jumble of crashed bikes on the roadway. And he's just telling me, hey, I need another time trial frame. I'm not sure what all's gone here, but I need a fresh time trial frame stat. And there was worry that the bike we'd built him and he'd been riding for quite some time. I think he'd ridden world championships the year before, should be about this time, so roll around to the prologue time, and I had to pull out drawings and get another frame in process really quick. And one of the issues with building that bike was we were taking thin sheets of titanium and fabricating aero tube shapes. And so just the down tube and the top tube and the head tube and the seat tube, you know, every single tube of this particular bike, with the exception of the chainstays, had seams on top and bottom. And so the amount of welding time just to make the tube set was a couple of days. And we didn't have this time. We didn't have this liberty of time. And we had the main triangle, the large tubes, top tube, down tube, seat tube. I had those tubes on hand. They were in our production bikes. But these seat stays, they were not. And Lance had made a comment in his voice message, and I think this was a bit later. Maybe this was an actual conversation. I can't recall. It's been so long ago. But he'd said something about giving John a call, that he was working on something new, and he had found some real benefits in shaping. And so I give John a quick call. I'm trying to rush these materials into play. And I give John a quick call and said, hey, Lance says you've been working on something. He goes, yeah, you wouldn't believe how good just a simple oval is performing. And I understand you've got an issue with the seat stays. He had heard my plea and said, yeah, just make a good oval set of seat stays for that second bike. And I think we'll be fine. And, you know, so John had just bought me hours in the fab shop, and off we went, built this backup bike. And then Lance rolls off the start in Paris, and he's on the original. So the bike had survived something massive. And then you look back on the follow car, and there was an unpaid. The reason I knew that he was on the original is it had been painted. And on the follow car was a stealthy raw titanium backup time trial bike. And so I don't know if the oval stay bike ever got ridden. I never saw it in on race course and footage, but stuck with the original. So and that was one of the more fun things that John and I talked about during and after. And there's been loads of conversations and athletes and things since, but I just think the world of him, and one of my heroes.
So he does a lot of work with saddles now, doesn't he? And the actual sitting position, is that right?
Say again now.
John Cobb does a lot of work on saddles now. Has he got a website called Speed and Comfort? And it seems to be all about saddles and bike fit.
Yeah. He started a saddle company, you know, and saddles have become a big part of what John has focused on recent years.
Hmm. So I'm quite interested in the Lance story then there. So it had never occurred to me that any of the bikes that the Pro Tour use are titanium, even if they're painted over and they might look like carbon fiber. Is that still a practice today, or do most of them just go for the standard off the peg stuff with trick gear on them?
No, it's that practice passed in the late 90s, really, is when it really waned. Early 2000s, contracts got rewritten, and guys are riding the production bikes, and the technology has improved drastically, so rightfully so.
Okay, then. So you've Steve Head, John Cobb, two of the best known designers that are out there, and obviously people that have guys that have mentored you. So, you're at Quintana Roo now, and you're their head designer. So let's talk about designing a bike. So the new PR6 and the PR5 and the PR3 are the current incarnations of the bikes that triathletes might see. And for those UK triathletes who haven't yet seen them, you must do. These bikes, if anything, have got, regardless of what's underneath, they've just got some fantastic paint jobs. But there's also a lot of thought gone into the design. So let's talk about that then, Brad. When you're designing a new bike, where do you start? What do you start with?
Well, let's just a touch of history. Back in the early 90s, Quintana was established, and it was the adversary. In triathlon, we at Lightspeed, we had a good triathlon program. Mm. And, Dan Enfield, wow, he was the evil enemy.
He still is. He still is for some people.
Yeah. So, over time, Lightspeed became a small group of brands, was named American Bicycle Group, and Quintana Roo was acquired. And at that point I had responsibility to design outside of the brand I'd grown up with, really. And, here in America, we always tend to relate things to, or at least folks of my age, we relate things to muscle cars. And I look at the auto industry and the horrible mistakes that I think General Motors made in having multiple brands and losing the soul, becoming, very corporate and losing the soul and the origin of each individual brand. You could essentially buy a sedan or a pickup truck, and it was the same thing with a different badge on it. It said GMC or Chevrolet or whatever the case may be.
Can I just interrupt you on that, Brad? It's interesting you bring that up. I've read a book called The Car Guys Versus the Bean Counters, which was written by Bob Lutz, who was the CEO, I think, of General Motors. And he talks about this exact subject, where the General Motors cars of the 60s were beautiful things. They've been designed by people like yourself with passion for cars and an understanding for design. And slowly the company was taken over by the bean counters, and they started wanting cars to be designed based around whether you could use these panels on that model as well and this one. And so, as you say, the cars became an absolute just a mess. And had no soul. And if you haven't read it, I'd recommend that. It's an amazing book about how a company was taken over by the accountants and pretty much destroyed.
Thanks for the recommendation, because that spirit is what drives me. And I hope that any work I'm ever a part of or responsible for within a brand, that there is a reflection on the soul and the spirit. And typically it's an individual of a brand. And so everything we've ever done in Quintana Roo, I always think, what would Dan do? You know, what would Dan do? And through this, you know, Dan and I, we don't talk so often. We're both quite busy, but when we do, it's always a very soulful conversation. And he's been amazingly respectful over the years. You know, Dan, as you know, he's not an ass kisser. He's going to tell you what he thinks. You know, it's oftentimes there's been, you know, a few times that I just show up at his doorstep and say, all right, what do you think of this? Or, you know, be a part of one of his clinics. We have differing approaches, but we still want the end result goal the same. It's been a great study and exercise of a product development, with Dan as an inspiration.
Okay. Let's go on to the PR6 then, cause that's your flagship bike at the moment. We'll be seeing a few of those in Kona. I think Matt Hansen rides one, and, I'm just trying to think who else would be riding one out there. I did see it the other day. You could probably remind me.
We'll have a number of athletes there. It's been a good season for QR athletes. So onto the bike itself. You know, we created this thing called Shift Technology. This is something that pulled a big grin upon Head's face when I'd met him at the A2 Wind Tunnel in Charlotte, North Carolina. It was an automotive and motorsports driven wind tunnel that we'd heard about, and we'd chatted on the phone, and you know, we talked to those guys. We organized a trip. He was bringing athletes. I was bringing bikes.
And who was this that you met? Sorry.
This was Steve. This was
Steve. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And so we had a really good session planned, and I showed up with this bike that was quite asymmetric. This bike was made with a lot of putty, a lot of Bondo. It was not a rideable bike, but it was very testable in the tunnel. I don't even remember the date on this, but a lot of things came from that. But I had this odd concept of asymmetry. I felt like Steve's wheels, when you tested wheels alone, and I would have never tested wheels alone had you know, Steve not, you know, got me being able to witness it through Steve. But, you know, I was really amazed at the opening and closing of the wind, of the air. And behind the front wheel, the goal is to return the air to the state in which you found it. As you penetrate the air, you want to close it right. You're opening it, but you want to close it right back. And so I'm seeing the characteristics of these wheels at various yaw angles. And I'm like, wow, why are we not paying attention to the pressure zones of the air and creating a diversion like you would do in motorsports? You're using air to appropriately either cool the brakes or create downforce, or you're using the air in a positive way, or you're diverting the air away from something that you don't want it catching, and something that you just got to deal with it. You can't hide it. And so this bike I had, it had a fairing around the chainstay, or excuse me, around the chainring. And I hadn't completely fared the front derailleur. There were just some ideas on what was going on there. But I had morphed the down tube over in front of the chain ring to naturally create a fairing. And what we ended up finding months later was it wasn't the fairing that was the best benefit of that bike. It was that we were taking this recollection of air off the front wheel and sending it down the clean side of the bike where there wasn't a chain ring. So rather than fair it, we learned diversion was the best technique.
Is that the shift technology? The guys, then you're shifting the air.
That is the shift technology.
Okay. Yeah. Right. So shifting air to, So
if the clean side of the bike.
So if I'm reading this right or listening to this right, when it comes past the wheel there, it's if you were able to see, you know, coloured air or something, it'd all be in a jumble and twisted and
yep.
everything. And you want it to return to that beautiful clean state. And if it hits the derailleur yep. or the chain wheel or the pedal, then that's going to remain disturbed. But if you can send it down the other side, it becomes cleaner and therefore it creates less drag or produces less drag. Is
yep.
that right?
Yep. And so what's happening, you know, across the wheel, through the fork, onto the down tube,
yep.
typically the down tube is crashing right back into this high pressure zone.
Right.
I shifted it. I sort of put it in an eddy, if you will, where there's a bit of turbulence. And then this massive recollection of air, I'm sending it down the clean side of the bike. The chain ring feels less air. It encounters less and of this recollection that comes off the front wheel. And then also we lifted the leading edge of the chainstay. It's a very non-aero tube, if you will, from a bike designer standpoint. It doesn't encounter a lot of air, but what I did was I removed the leading edge, but in doing so, we created a lot of surface area. So on a positive yaw situation where air is coming to you across your left shoulder, your 60 millimeter depth rear wheel is going to react more like, say, a 90 millimeter depth rear wheel due to the added surface area that we designed into the bike. And, we just improved the sail effect, if you will. So there are certain yaw angles that the bike just, you know, we could simply enhance the properties and enhance the aero and move forward.
So that, I guess that would be a good thing if you weren't in a situation where you're getting a lot of crosswinds, wouldn't it? Because if a 60 mil wheel's behaving like a 90 mil wheel because of what you've built into the frame, does that become a problem at any time when you've got strong
actually
crosswinds?
No, because we're focusing it, you know, in an area that isn't damaged by the crosswinds. It doesn't create instability. We've actually got the aero benefit. We've done it in a stable way. We didn't do it on the front wheel, of course. We didn't do it out on the extents of the rear wheel. We just added surface area in a localized area that otherwise typically creates wheel turbulence, and we minimized. So it was really a fun study, and all of this, you know, all of these bits and pieces add up into what is the PR series Quintana Roo.
Okay, so that means that we're starting from an aero perspective then, I guess. So is it important that your bikes are beautiful looking as well? Is it important to you that they look significant? Because I have to say that if you look a lot of the manufacturers now, when they've got the little storage bins on the back of the seat tube, when they've got the little storage bins on top of the top tube, the way they've got the integrated headset, if you took off some of the decals, a lot of the bikes would look very similar, as if they were produced in the same factory from the same mold. So how important is it for you for Quintana Roo bikes to look different, or can you just do that through the paint?
You know, I think I can honestly say I've never been driven by style. I'm a very function before fashion thinker. I'm more about the puzzle. I don't think so much about the end result look, and that tends to drive the marketing folks crazy.
Yes, yes, because the average triathlete that I know, they'll go, yeah, don't you like the way my bike looks? If it rides like a crock of, you know, a crock of shit, they're not that bothered sometimes, because as long as it makes them look good, that's all they're really interested in front of the friends.
Yeah, I think that's why I'm a far less popular designer. Because I haven't been so worried about the marketing. So no, that's horrible to say, but in some regards, it's true. The PR series had a lot of design objectives. First was performance, but the second piece of performance, you know, alongside aero, I won't put it above or below, but with the aero is. All of that is nothing if the bike isn't position capable. The fit windows of each and every one of our bikes. And when I look at our bikes, I'm looking at each size almost as an individual model. I think I get overly passionate about that because the fit window of our 48 centimeter bike versus our 50 centimeter bike versus our 52. I want there to be a logical progression. I want an athlete to have choice. If we really get to the meat and potatoes of it, where the exercise is done properly when it comes to size selection and the fit of the athlete on the bike, your more advanced coaches understand schools of fit. They may not be a fitter themselves, but they have an expert in the quiver. And one of the trends among some elites is upsizing the bike. They've understood that more aero profile on a bike can be beneficial. And rather than downsizing the bike and opening, you know, creating more of an issue of seat post turbulence and that sort of thing, you can have more positive cross-sectional shape, upsizing by 2 centimeters and still maintaining the exact same position is very important. Uh-huh. And I'll go outside of Quintana Roo. I don't like to sound like I'm, you know, beating our drum and selling something to someone. So look at Luke McKenzie within our brand. Look at Matt Hansen. There's multiple athletes. It's always immediately recognizable when they've been somewhat what I would consider upsized in their fit and positioning, but someone's done a really good job of putting a bike beneath them. The old school mindset would say, oh, that bike's too big for him. What's he doing on his big brother's bike? But the position is perfect and it just appears to be a little larger frame size. And that, I'm sure you've seen that with multiple athletes, but it's a bit of a trend going right now.
Yeah, because I can definitely agree with that observation that there were athletes going towards small size to have a smaller size, maybe have a shorter crank arm, you know, have more space around that area around the chest so they could breathe, getting into a better aero position.
Schools of fit, schools of fit range greatly. I go all the way back to New England Cycling Academy and the old fit kit. As we progress, there's been so many systems. I'm always very, very mindful and cognizant of who we're interacting with, sometimes with this, if it's a coach or if it's a fitter specifically. I've tried to keep a very keen ear and my skills sharp, if you will, when it comes to fitting, but be very accommodating. I'm not here to preach schools of fit. I'm here to design bikes that adapt to how you want to put athletes upon the bike and how you think you can gain performance for that athlete by better positioning them on the bike. And it's funny. Back in the 90s, we were doing some crazy things with super low cockpits. And, I think the worst thing we ever did was I built custom stems for some Pro Tour guys that were so far down in front of the head tube. I actually had to cut a relief around the headset.
Wow.
If that makes sense, you know? And so we're getting the bars just super low because, head tubes have got to be a given length on welded metal bikes, and that's what we were building at the time. But it puzzles me that we just can't seem to lose the lower is faster mindset as we stand back and look at a bike. Ideally, as you're just standing looking at it, sure, lower is going to be faster, right? And it's not always the case. And that's some of the things that I've been really fortunate to go through the exercises, not only developing products, but also trying to help athletes in the meantime.
It seems to me also that not just frame fitters. I mean, if you're a frame fitter, so you get the bike after it's been made, you're often then trying to fit the bike to the athlete, aren't you? Rather than go the other way around and find the frame that fits the athlete. Now, and I know also that that there are some bike fitters out there that have this idea that the praying mantis position is the best, and then some that have the aero bars flat, some that like their athletes to get really low at the front end, I do wonder sometimes whether the fitters are actually trying to create something in their own mold rather than finding the best for the athlete. And surely when you're designing a bike as well, it's athlete centered. The bike in itself isn't going to get to the finish line. It's got to be ridden by somebody, and some in triathlon as well, that person's got to be able to run comfortably off the bike. So it's no good being one of those Uber bikers who gets off the bike. And there've been several that were like this that posted awesome bike splits and then ran like a drunkard.
That's right.
Going up the street, and so
And you were driving a bit earlier on the fashion. You know how a bike looks now. Mm. The fashion of a fit is one thing that absolutely drives me mad, and you know we've seen it time and time again where you know people are fitting an athlete, or an athlete is self fitting themselves in a mirror or something, and they're going. You know, trying to look like Sebi. You know, they're looking. You know, they're so inspired by Kinley that's how they have to look on course, and that's wonderful that the heroes of our sport inspire, you know, products and positions and how we do things. But you know, for me as a bike designer, I've got to allow an athlete to be properly positioned so that they can maximize their performance. And the one rule that I always try to impress upon folks, or I try to encourage a fitter, if I know they're working with an athlete I know, is please do me one favor. Please do me one favor when you're setting someone up on our bike or anyone else's. You can have the athlete 5 centimeters too high, but please don't get them 5 millimeters too low. Because the difference is drastic. Mm. You can absolutely wreck someone's performance by erring to the low, and you put them into a position, and we've all seen it. If you go 5 millimeters too low, what's going to happen at mile 40? Maybe it happens sooner, maybe it happens later, but what's going to happen, Simon? They're going to resist the position, and all of a sudden, they open up. And typically the opening up happens not far out of transition. You know, if they're really coached well on position, the head never is capable of falling. You know, I had a particular athlete here in our facility. I occasionally work with athletes here at Quintana Roo, and most of my fitting is done outside. It's not something I do professionally. It's not my job. It's something I just do out of joy, but had someone in, and they were past that point. They'd really fashionably set themselves up, and cockpit far too low. You know, I've got large sheets of paper here that for our production drawing. So when I pinned a big sheet of paper on the wall and I cast a shadow, this was really ghetto. I cast a shadow with the light on the wall, and I traced their position, and then I added about 1.5 centimeters of stack and got them comfortable. We went through a bit of an exercise there. We got their hand position right. They were comfortable on the bike, and they were just, their mind was going mad that I'd raised them, but I'd settled them, and I'd let the head fall and sort of cradle between the shoulders. And I clicked the light back on, went over and traced the shadow, and we brought them down 4 centimeters on the shadow. Now, this wasn't an accurate measurement, but it was representation. I brought the cockpit up. They'd found a more relaxed position. I'd coached them into better posture on the bike, and their power sustainability, because they had really good power data, their power sustainability went off the charts. And the point at which they started falling off drastically didn't happen in their next race. It's exercises like that really inspire me as a designer, because I know our fit capability is more important in some cases than the aerodynamics that we will spend tens of thousands of dollars studying. You know, it's really simple that we get specific within each individual athlete and try to help them maximize their performance.
I just go back to your comments a while back about the once the air comes off the front wheel and trying to get it back into a smooth position. And I'm looking at a picture of the Diamondback which looks more like a motorbike to me. And it's got this great big front fairing that almost circles around underneath the wheel and then goes back in a nice line. It's almost hiding the chain set there. I mean, I've seen those bikes and they seem to polarize opinion. I've seen it in the flesh and it seems to polarize opinion. Some people say it's beautiful. Some people say it's ugly. Do you see that? Is that just something that Diamondback have done to be different, or does it does it have some merits? And is that the way bike design, particularly for the elite guys who are wanting to get faster, is that the way it's going?
Oh no, there's a brilliant group of guys behind that. You know, a lot of ways to accomplish the goal, but they did a really smart thing in trying to keep the air open, not, you know, stay as close behind the wheel and keep the air open, not let it close, and let it flow equally to drive and non-drive side of the bike. I'm shifting it to the non-drive side. It's a total different approach, but there's a lot of validity in what was put into that design. Some of it I don't agree with, but I think it was a wonderful approach. Where I think that particular design goes awry is in crosswinds. You know, I think the stability, you can get in a laboratory and create some wonderful things, but out in the real world, it's, you know, I someone would ask me, they said, oh wow, I think it was at the time that bike had come out, like, oh, where's bike design going? And I said, you know, the ones that get my attention in the future are going to be slimmer, they're going to be lighter, and they're going to handle really, really well in Kona. Yeah. So that's, you know, I didn't want to just come right out and say it's not going to be that one, but that's kind of what was in my head. And
you talk about the real world there, so let's talk about the real world now. Disc brakes, right, now I have two bikes with disc brakes. I've had mountain bikes in the past, I've had a cyclocross bike. My current incarnation of a road bike, which is a light speed, has disc brakes, and so does my triathlon bike. Now, having cycled in the Alps, I am a massive advocate of disc brakes there. You know, better stopping power, no problem with rims heating up, just better all round, better in the wet, easier on the fingers when you're descending for, you know, 20, 30 minutes and your arms aren't like Popeye. Time trial bikes, I'm still not sure. And I know that there's a division in the bike industry. Some of the time trial bikes that are out there have them, particularly that we're talking about going to Kona. There'll be some bikes out there with them and there'll be a lot without. So as a designer, I saw you'd done a post recently on disc brakes. So give me your perspective, please, because I am I'll argue in favor of disc brakes now, but I know a lot of people don't. So if I hear it from you, this is from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, so I'll argue both sides of the point. I want to preach the benefits of both, but first and foremost, let's just throw it out there. There's safety issues. When I go to a world championship event in Zell-MC, Austria, and I see as many tires off the rims and the brake conditions of bikes before the event, because I wrenched on a lot of bikes before that event, and I had no idea how many sets of brake pads I should have shown up with. And then I had the fear. Race morning, it hit me. I'm walking down to the swim start, and it hit me. I just created more heat on the rim surface. I just created, and all these brakes that I improved, I created a greater potential blow-off situation for these athletes. And I'll be honest, I was on pins and needles. I resisted going out on course on the major descent there. I was a bundle of nerves.
This is when they had the 70.3 World Championships in Zell-MC, isn't it? Because I've ridden that course that comes down from Deanton to Maria Raum, and it's a beautiful descent. I don't recall it having lots of braking requirements there. I do recall hitting some quite high speeds there because you could just let go.
And that is the case with some of us, and we're taking for granted, Simon, that.
Yeah,
that's how we ride our bikes. But for the swim specialist or the run specialist who doesn't come from a cycling background, they were all over the brakes. And the situations that did happen at that event, it happened again the following year in my hometown. 70.3 Worlds was in my hometown the following year in Chattanooga. We had a free-flowing descent. I mean, Ironman puts together fantastic courses, but the athlete's comfort level is most important. And when there is heavy braking, and I do agree that triathlon's probably the segment of the sport where disc is maybe least necessary. I don't know. I mean, we'll know better in 10 years. We continue to grow and gain knowledge, but I do know that the improved braking is safer. Hands down, we're not taking, you know, your investment in wheels that cost thousands of dollars, and we're not using the carbon fiber surfaces as a friction braking surface. It doesn't wear away your wheels with the discs. The braking surface is replaceable. So the aero benefits and the structural benefits of the wheels, they're just going to last longer, and your investment in the wheel set and in the bicycle is far better because of disc brakes. All that aside, the thing we have found now, having disc brakes in our product line for quite some time now, on multiple levels of product, our PR6, our PR5, this is a recurring, it's growing weekly. We hear it more and more often, but it's the folks that come back and give us their splits. They give us their data, and it's typically on a climb. And they say this bike climbs so much better. And the reasoning is, you know, the true physics behind it is the through axles. When you take a design like ours and we simply plug and play disc brakes into it, there wasn't a great deal of noticeable structural change in the carbon fiber layup and so forth. We did shroud the rear caliper and we created some aero benefits. But when it comes to standing and accelerating, the disc brake bikes are more efficient.
Oh, so that it's the through axle which creates more stability and strength at the frame when you're standing up, and when there's a potential for it to twist, it doesn't do that, and so therefore more power that you put into the pedals goes through to the ground rather than being lost in the twisting of the bike. Is that it?
That's it. Energy transfer is better. Period.
Right. And so what?
So and it has nothing to do with braking. It has all to do with acceleration and sustaining speed. If you're encountering a roller, you're out on the Queen K and you're just on the brink of making a shift. And, you know, how many watts is it going to cost me to gear and continue to burn this split? You're more efficient. More efficient. That's all there is to it. As the wattage goes up and you're trying to hold that, you're more efficient on discs.
I've not heard that argument from anyone anywhere on any social media post where there's
it's got to be properly tested. And you know, I should be the guy driving to do that. And I'm just hearing it from athletes. I'm being shown power data. I'm my jaw's hanging. You know, athletes who are down on their training this year, showing me better bike splits. There's no reason for it. And they smile and they attribute it all to the bike. And I'm just shaking my head. No, there's more to it than that. We know there's more variables than that. But, you know, when it comes right down to well-trained athletes who are monitoring data and those hill splits seem to be where, you know, the higher wattage splits are where they seem to be having gained some efficiency. So,
wow. So,
yep.
Just to summarize then, they're faster because they do have better braking. Certainly, you don't get the heated rims, so you've less danger, particularly on a long descent where you've either got to brake because of the corners or whether you brake because you're not quite as comfortable at high speeds. There's less chance of wearing those rims down. So if you've got a pair of top-of-the-range zip or head wheels or Reynolds wheels, you're less likely to have to replace them because the rims are worn. When they do get worn down, you can replace either discs or before that the pads. But it's just, it gives you more power because there's less flex in the frame when you're accelerating.
Yep. And I recently, it's funny, when this topic came up just recently, I grabbed a caliper brake bike, aired up the tires, and I thought, you know, I'm going to reacclimate myself because I'm fortunate. I can go into this forwards and backwards, and I've got a couple of years of road disc experience now. I'm going to go sit on my Tuesday night ride and you know, I'm going to do it on a different bike. This is an R&D bike. And it was amazing. Caliper brakes, the braking points You know, we live in a very hilly area here. So I didn't realize that my braking points had really become much more delayed on discs. And I drug the brakes much less with discs. You mm-hmm. don't just have that steady finger on the, you know, dragging the brake in the pack, or, you know, you got to do that with rim brakes. And it, with discs, you can just let it go and then all of a sudden punch it and they respond really well. They don't fade. They're fantastic. So
I concur with that. I got my bike with disc brakes 2 weeks before we went on a riding trip to the Alps, road riding trip. Yep. And I've got some fairly tasty mates when it comes to descending, and a few of them like to descend fast. So we were regularly touching speeds of over 70 or 80 K an hour. And one night we had this competition to see who got down to the town sign first on our first night. And there was four of us in the end. And coming into some of those hairpins on those alpine roads, we were absolutely flying. And I did find exactly what you've just said, that you can just brake. They'd be 20 meters ahead. And then as we came into the hairpin, I'd be right on the back wheel because I'd just been able to brake later and more safely. And then I could get out. And then maybe because of that through axle thing, I could get out of the corner a little bit better as well. And then, of course, the brakes started heating up and they were losing the braking anyway. So they were having to ease back because they just couldn't slow down. So that was great. That was I'm definitely a convert, but I don't think you can argue from a position of strength about whether the discs are useful or not until you've actually tried them and compared them. And then when you know.
Yeah, you just pulled a flashback out of me. I got to attend a camp with Simon Whitfield, Jordan Rapp, Jasper Blake. There was a good group of guys there, and we'd ridden Mount Lemmon, and it was still early. It was January, so we only got partial way up the mountain and then the gates closed and, you know, the conditions above were still snowy. But we got up to the turning point and then descended back down. I had them on mass. I had them handily. I was like, gravity's my friend. I'm going to smoke these guys. And this is some, you know, long it has been 10 years or more, but I used to be that guy. I'm not that guy anymore. But the fun. I wish I'd had a proper disc bike back then. Yeah,
I'm a little heavier than some of my mates, and they're more mountain runners who can cycle, and I have to concede a lot of time to them going uphill, so to get one over them on the downhill when I can drop them all is reward enough.
We live in the same world, my friend.
So, Brad, we've got a few minutes left now before we need to end the call, and you've got to go about your daily business there. But I did want to ask you, as I ride along with my friends, and we have our disc brakes and we have our through axles and we have our electric, our DI2 or our SRAM ETAP, you know, our Wi-Fi gears. And I think, where are the next movements coming from in terms of bike design? What is there left to change? I've seen that there's a pro tour team in Europe, Aqua Blue, that are riding a single chain wheel at the front, a bit like a mountain bike, and obviously that is lighter, but then there's ICU limits or UCI limits on weight anyway, so making a bike lighter doesn't necessarily have any benefits because then you have to put some weights in it to meet the minimum restrictions. So where's it all going? What's the next innovation we're going to see from bike design?
Yeah, so it's certainly not going to be from Aqua Blue, unfortunately. the team isn't going to continue on. But we should all stand back and take notice. And I'm saying the bike industry. I think a good technology was put on those boys, and they didn't receive it well. You know, and it may be one of the reasons or the primary reason, a fault of the team not moving forward, but we're in far worse conditions racing mountain bikes and gravel on one by. So I think one by is definitely not going to run away soon. We were just on a mountain bike ride yesterday, a good long one. And we were laughing about who's going to be the first old school guy to go back to multi-chain rings, you know? So the talk off road, you know, we've been one by for so long. We don't have the issues that Aqua Blue has claimed and so forth. I think One By is fantastic. It doesn't work for everyone, but for those it does, it's great.
And when did, sorry, Brad, can I just interrupt? When you say One By, then that's a term I'm not familiar with.
Okay, One By, single chainring only.
Oh, okay, right.
Yep. So that does simplify the bike. It loses the front derailleur. You've essentially lost a shifter. It reduces the cost to build a race bike drastically because, you know, electronic shifters and derailleurs aren't cheap now, are they? So the cranksets are somewhat more cost efficient because you've only got one chainring. So there's some economics there, but from a design standpoint, the bike did just get more aero. So, we just keep piling up these benefits. And so I tip my hat. SRAM is driving the One By craze. I tip my hat to those boys. They've done fantastic work. And I hope that I've made my bike very One By specific capable. We can remove and install a front derailleur mount. And the aerodynamics of my bike in a One By mode benefit greatly. You know, unfortunately, I am taking some air off the front chain rings, so I'm not getting full penalty of a dual chain ring system today. But I still applaud that innovation. The other innovations that are coming, we're going to continue to see some fantastic things happen in wheels and tire size, because we no longer, or we're seeing less of the limitation of a rim brake caliper. We're going to be able to create better wheel sets and better tire systems that will improve safety. It will improve our splits. It will improve our comfort and enjoyment of the ride. So we're going to have to account for that. Fortunately, I've always been a little bit mad with additional tire clearance. So I think I'm already there, but there are others, some other folks that, you know, when I'm looking for premium road forks for my titanium bikes, not everyone's been paying attention to tire size necessity and globally. But I think the integration, you know, we've seen great things happen in integration when it comes to storage, when it comes to nutrition. But I'm afraid we're moving into a phase we went through over the past 10 years, and we've come out of it a little bit. But I think there's some over-engineering going on. There's some complication. You know, we'll stay focused on making a bike really enhance the athlete's experience, and we don't want to complicate it. I think we did invent simple in triathlon. I think we've driven our stake in the ground, and some of our competitors have followed suit, and they're also promoting simplicity. But being what I think are the founders of simplicity and pure performance, that's where we'll keep our stake and not create any extra drama and small bits to be lost and difficult to work on for our athletes.
Well, that's important to me. And as I think we chatted about before, you know, there are definitely some bikes out there which look fantastic, but I liken them to having a relationship with a supermodel. Fantastic to have on your arm, fantastic to be seen with, but an absolute nightmare behind the scenes. And there's definitely something to be said for having a bike where you take it out of your bike bag when you get to your destination on a bike camp or something, and you use one Allen key or two max to readjust the handlebars, to adjust the headset, to adjust your saddle, and you're off and running. And yep. The rest of your friends are still there with their full toolkit laid out on the ground, kicking everything and swearing and ready to throw the bike off the balcony.
That's it.
And so if we take that video about the crazy hot index for females, which was very funny, then, you know, having a bike would – you wouldn't want a crazy hot bike that you couldn't live with. You'd want a steady bike that was easy to work with. So I think you've done a good job there, Brad. And
we try to make it pretty and handsome. We're working hard here and trying to appeal to all athletes. It's a wonderful sport to find ourselves in. It's just fantastic. And we've sat here and we've talked about bikes. We've talked about equipment. We've talked about a little bit. I want to commend you. The product that you're producing and the information that you're delivering is so inspiring. I've listened to the podcast. We've been trying to get together for quite some time, and I've become a follower. But you know, as a bike designer, I'm listening to Dave Schell. When was that? That was back.
Dave. Yeah, from Training Peaks. That was probably 2 or 3 months ago now. When Dave.
That was back in the summer. Yeah. And I'm hearing in that, and I've heard it through you in the past as well. But you have a keen sense of all the variables, and you were pointing out heat and how does heat affect, you know, do you need to make adjustments? And I had just come off an event that I had drastically overheated myself. And I was like, man, oh man, I'm going to go back and listen to this one over and over again. I'm now inspired to get a little sharper with my personal training. I might go back dipping back into Training Peaks, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful world that we live in. And so I want to commend you on the product you're providing and the messages you're delivering to folks. It's so important, and I applaud you.
Well, thank you, Brad. It's nice to sign off with a compliment like that. Some people might think I should cut this bit from the show because sounds like we're blowing my own trumpet a bit, but oh, it's a mutual admiration call. But I appreciate your comments.
The history,
thank you.
The stories that you bring, and it's all so inspiring, and I really enjoy it. I genuinely enjoy it.
Well, that's a great note to finish on. And Brad, I thank you for your insight into bike design and the future of bikes and why bike design is sort of trending to a particular way, particularly the debate on disc brakes. That's been quite insightful, and I've learned a couple of things there. I appreciate you taking the time to join us today. Listeners, that was Brad Devaney, bike design guru from Quintana Roo Bikes. I will be putting some show notes up there for you to have a look at, including some of Brad's designs, and we'll reference John Cobb and Steve Head and some of those other people there, Dan Empfield of Slow Twitch, which you might be aware of. So thank you, Brad, for being on the show today. Fantastic insights.
Thanks for your time, Simon.
And listeners, thank you once again for joining us today. As I say always, I appreciate the fact that there's lots of podcasts out there about triathlon and triathlon-related subjects. You have a lot to choose from, so I do appreciate the fact that you choose to come back here on a regular basis. And you can rest assured that I'm continually searching out some amazing guests for you to listen to. And so I'll be back next week with another one of those guests. But for now, thanks for listening. Have a good week. That wraps up this week's episode. I'd just like to say thank you for taking the time to listen to the conversation today. And I hope you learned at least one thing that you can put into practice in your training. Now, if this was your first time listening, please go back and listen to our previous episodes. I can guarantee that they will be just as good as you heard from today's guest. If you've listened to all the episodes so far, then thank you so much for continuing this learning journey with me. As you might be aware, reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so I would really appreciate it if you could leave a review and a rating on iTunes or Podbean. You could also follow me at the same time. I also have a free gift for you. In 30 years of competing in triathlon, 20 years of coaching, I've learned an awful lot from my own experiences and from some of the guests who have and will appear on this show. And I feel it's my duty, as I approach the latter stage of my coaching career, to share these with you. So I've put together 25 of my best training, racing and lifestyle strategies, and I've squeezed them down into just 2 pages of content. And in order to get hold of this, all you need to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com, and she will send it right back out to you. You could also think about joining my Facebook community. It's called the Triathlon Coach Cafe. We've got over 2,300 members just like you, eager to find out more about how to improve their training and share their successes with people. It's free to join, but you will have to ask. So go along there, answer the questions, and then we'll even do a little video each week to answer your questions. Finally, if you want to make sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe using Podbean or iTunes. We release new episodes every Wednesday. So that's all for now. See you again next week, same time, same place.